born in Philadelphia. Live from the Tasty Cake Studios, this is Philadelphia's sports leader, Sports Radio 94 WIP.
And now, the Public Affairs Department of Sports Radio WIP presents Conversations with Peter Solomon, a weekly focus on the issues and people making a difference in Philadelphia and the Delaware Valley. This is Conversations with Peter Solomon.
Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIP Sports Radio as we ease on into WIP Sunday, and a chilly WIP Sunday it promises to be. It's cold out there. It's icy out there. There was just enough snow last night to be really annoying. There's ice and snow on the ground, on the streets, and on your car. So if you're out and about this morning, please be careful. If you have to be out, take 94 WIP with you no matter where you go. This morning's conversation is going to be something that's going to be fun for me and hopefully enlightening for you as we go back in time to discuss historical fact and learn something that we can hopefully bring to today's world as well. If you listen carefully, you can hear waltz music as we go back in time to the last imperial family of Tsarist Russia. As we welcome my guest, Helen Azar, she's written The Diary of Olga Romanov, Royal Witness to the Russian Revolution. It was the final years of the last Romanov family, the last imperial family of Russia. Olga Romanov kept a diary of the end of an imperial family, the end of a dynasty. Good morning, Helen Azar.
Good morning.
Helen, it's a fascinating story, isn't it?
Yes, it sure is. It's better than fiction.
And I find it has ramifications for today as revolutions of what people would term despotic governments and despotic families continue around the world.
Yes, history just keeps repeating itself, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Now, who was the Romanov family and Nicholas and Alexandra Romanov?
Well, Nicholas II was the last Tsar of Russia, as you know. He became Tsar in 1894. When his father died relatively young, before he was 50 years old. At the same time, he married his wife, Alexandra, who was a German princess. His parents initially were against him marrying her, but as his father got sick, they decided he needed to be married, so they did get married right after the father, Alexander III, died unexpectedly. She was the granddaughter of Queen Victoria. So she kind of ended up in a completely different environment than she grew up in Germany and England. So she was not prepared, he was not prepared, and they sort of both ended up ruling Russia in their early to mid-20s, is how old they were.
And they had how many children?
They had four girls, and they had one boy, who was the youngest, and only the boy could inherit, so they kept trying for a boy so they could have an heir to the throne. And, of course, a lot of people know that once the boy was born, he was born with a really terrible, serious disease called hemophilia, which is an inherited disease. His mother passed it on to him, and it actually came down from Queen Victoria to her genetically. So a few of her progeny had hemophilia, but in this case it was very serious because hemophilia, once you got the diagnosis of hemophilia, you really were not expected to live very long. So it was pretty serious for them. It was pretty serious for Russia.
And that was critical to have an heir to the throne, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. because only males could inherit the throne. So that was serious in a lot of ways for them. So they basically would do anything to keep this boy alive as parents and as rulers.
And Olga was what in terms of the four daughters?
She was the oldest. She was the oldest. So if it wasn't for the Salic law, which is, Salic law is, tells us that only males can inherit. Russia actually had semi-Salic law, which means that you kind of had a run out of all the males and then the female can inherit. But if it wasn't for that, she would be the heir to the throne. So she would be the Tsarina, basically. Or if her little brother died. So yeah, she was the oldest. And in fact, she was the first one, she was the only one born before they got crowned, her parents.
And what kind of a person was Olga?
Well, she was, looking at the diaries, you cannot get a lot of emotional type of reactions or emotional or a lot of like deep kind of thinking, because diaries back then were for just putting down events and facts, and it was more like a calendar rather than a diary the way we think of it right now in the modern days. I did include a lot of letters which she wrote, and there you can really see what kind of person she was, and that's where she got really emotional. She put down her thoughts and feelings. There are a lot of descriptions by people who knew her, and everyone said that she was the most thoughtful out of all the children. She tended to be a little bit melancholy. She was the most studious. She loved to read. She really was very close to her mother. She felt a lot of empathy for her mother. Her mother was not a well woman. She was sick a lot. She loved her brother. She loved her sisters. She was really a very regular girl. When you're reading her diaries and letters, you sort of think like, wow, you know, she could be anybody.
I'm intrigued by something, Helen Azar. Mm-hmm. The revolution was a tumultuous time, certainly. And jumping to the end for a minute, the entire family was shot in a basement in Siberia. So they all died. At least we believe they all died.
They all died.
The family, okay. Well, some people don't believe they all died, but that's another discussion. The palaces were ransacked. The revolution happened. The people around them, a lot of them died as well. How did these diaries and letters survive?
You know, when the family was first arrested, they lived in the palace, in the Alexander Palace for a few months, which was their regular residence. At the time, it was the provisional government who took over. At the time, nobody really knew what would happen. Nobody knew they would go into exile. Nobody knew they would end up being executed. When things got really kind of heated, so to speak, the provisional government head, Alexander Kerensky, decided that it would be safer for the family to sort of take them away from the St. Petersburg area where all the action was. And they, of course, were told they're going somewhere. They weren't told they were going to Siberia. And they were told to take warm clothes, so they sort of figured out that, yes, we're probably going to Siberia. At this time, they packed all their things they wanted to take with them and into crates and chests and things like that. And their diaries were some of the things they packed away. In fact, this is probably we got lucky because it's probably one of the reasons why we didn't get burned. The two younger daughters, Maria and Anastasia, actually burned their diaries. Only a few, I think like 1 year of each diary survived for them. Whereas Olga and Tatiana, the two older daughters, they did not burn their diaries. Their diaries survived. And I think it's my theory, it's because they packed theirs away and they weren't accessible to them. So they did stay with their belongings. And when the Bolsheviks took over, they, of course, ended up transferring them again to the Urals, and their things went with them. And after they got executed, they went through their things, and they repacked it and sent everything off to Moscow. And that's how everything survived, the diaries, some of the letters. A lot of the writing the family did was burnt by them, but a lot did survive, so including the diaries.
And how did you get access?
Well, you can. The Russian archives does have it scanned onto microfilm, and you can actually request copies from them. It's a little tough to deal with them, especially long distance. But it's very possible to get the scans of various documents if you really want to. And basically, I requested copies on microfilm and got them.
Why? Why did you request the copies? Why did you embark on this project?
Well, you know, there have been so many books written on the last Tsar and his wife, and of course the children are mentioned somewhere in the background, sort of like as footnotes, but no one's really written anything specifically about the children, not even the son, the heir to the throne. There really hasn't been a book written, kind of like a biography or something based on specifically on them as people, as individuals. So I thought it would almost be like a tribute to these girls, to Olga specifically as an individual and not just as a footnote in history, where she could sort of speak out in her own words. And, you know, I think it's important that these children get the recognition, too, because they did live, they did die along with their parents, and they were innocents, and they basically died just for who they were born, nothing else. They did nothing wrong.
Their parents, though, they did a lot wrong, didn't they?
Well, Nicholas obviously did a lot wrong. He was the Tsar. He had the power. He could have sort of taken the country one way or another way, and his decisions meant a lot. He made a lot of wrong decisions. At the time, he thought they were right, but you know, hindsight 2020, it's easy to say, like, oh, well, he should have done this. He was not a great ruler. I think everybody can agree on that. But I think he did try to do his best. It wasn't sort of like, oh, well, I'm going to do this, so who cares? You know, I think he really did think he was doing the right thing. His wife was really didn't have the power. I mean, she had his ear, but in the end, he did end up, when he really wanted to do something, he did it, whether she liked it or not. So I think in a way, she was given a little too much credit in her involvement, as was Rasputin. But that's a whole different story.
One of the things I read about Nicholas and his power as Tsar was if you got a divorce in Russia, your divorce decree had to be personally signed by the Tsar.
Yes. Yeah, that was the autocracy. This is why it didn't work, because one person simply can't handle all that, and one person, if they happen to be not in the right job, so to speak, then it becomes a mess, and so that's the danger of autocracy. Of course, they felt that their power was given to them by God, so they had to be right. And that's a very dangerous thing, I think, as we see over and over, I think.
And it was a family of incredible wealth, too, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, of course. Except they weren't the richest family in Russia. That was the Yusupovs. So even being the Tsar, he was not the richest.
That's amazing to me, because when I think of Nicholas and Alexandra, I think of the Fabergé eggs.
Mm-hmm.
How beautiful and probably how expensive they were.
Well, don't get me wrong, they were very rich, but there were noble families that actually had more than the Tsar, even. So, as amazing as that sounds. And everybody else had, those families had Fabergé eggs, too. It wasn't just the Tsar.
All right. And earlier you mentioned their need to keep Alexei, the young child, the heir to the throne, alive, which brought a very important player into this story, into the picture, and that was Rasputin, also known as the Mad Monk.
Mm-hmm.
How did he come into this?
Well, the imperial couple had finally had this little boy who was so long awaited and who was so needed for to be the heir of the Russian throne. And a few weeks later, they found out that he has hemophilia, which pretty much in at that time was almost like a death sentence. Alexandra was very, very religious. She had converted to Russian Orthodoxy from Lutheranism, because she was German originally. She converted, and she became very, 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 very avidly Orthodox, just like a lot of new converts are. She sort of like really dived into the whole thing head first.
Helen, we have to take a brief break here, and we'll find out more about Rasputin and Alexandra when we come back in just a bit with Helen Azar, author of The Diary of Olga Romanov, Royal Witness to the Russian Revolution. But we've got to run a few commercials here to pay the bills here on 94 WIP Sports Radio. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday. I'm Peter Solomon, and my guest this morning, Helen Azar, author of The Diary of Olga Romanov, Royal Witness to the Russian Revolution. We're talking history of the Russian Revolution and the last imperial family of Russia as we talk about that and a whole lot more with Helen Azar. Helen, we were talking about Rasputin, the Mad Monk of Russia.
Yes, well, Rasputin wasn't even really a monk. Let's start there. He was a Siberian peasant who didn't really have any kind of a title in a church, but he was apparently had the gift of healing, which wasn't that uncommon in Siberia during that time, and even now. He ended up coming to St. Petersburg. He ran into some noblemen who got fascinated with him, decided to introduce him to the imperial couple. Alexandra had completely believed that God will heal her son, will send somebody to heal her son, to cure her son, in fact, from hemophilia, and she felt that Rasputin was that man. And in fact, Rasputin was able to do something, we don't know what, to stop the bleeding. The few times that Alexei came close to death, he was able to do what the doctors couldn't do. So that, of course, reinforced their faith in this man. And he became very close to the imperial family. And for about 10 years or so, they had a relationship with this man, but not in a in the way that rumor had it. They really respected him as a quote-unquote man of God, and he was able to come through for them at times.
Well, Rasputin, though, rumor had it, was a sexually active, sexually promiscuous individual that every lady, imperial, noble, or peasant saw the inside of his bedroom at one time or another.
Yeah, I wouldn't say every, but a lot of them did. Yep. I don't even think he ever denied that. And he wasn't even trying to hide it, to be honest, which is, that's the funny part. He was not trying to hide it. He was very different in front of the imperial couple, but he knew that things would get back to them. However, he never tried to hide the fact that he was promiscuous. He drank a lot, and I think when he drank a lot, it sort of just, he had no filters. He just did as he wanted, and I think that was part of the reason why a lot of people hated him.
There were also rumors, as you alluded to, that Alexandra and the daughters fell victim to him as well.
Right. No, I seriously doubt it. I think those were just rumors. That was not something that I can see happening at all.
In the papers you found in Olga's diary and the letters and such, how did Olga view him?
Oh, she said nothing but good things about him. I think it seemed that she really believed that she felt the same way as her mother did. She really believed that he was a holy man. There's a point after his death where she talks about writing down his thoughts and his teachings. In other words, like his quotes. He used to write down different quotes on pieces of the paper, and it sounds like they might have saved them. And so she was. There was a point where she's writing about it in the diary, and Anna Vorobeva, the friend, the very close friend of the family, was dictating it to her, and she was writing them down. And she actually wrote about that in the diary, saying this is what they were doing. So she felt very, very affectionate towards him, as did the rest of the family. After all, he did, as far as they were concerned, he did save their little brother more than once.
While all this was going on, World War I was also happening.
Yes. Yes. So the diaries pretty much cover the entire, 1914 to 1917, almost the entire time. It is World War I, where she basically talks a lot about working at the infirmary at the hospital that they set up for the wounded. Olga and her sister Tatiana and her mother actually got certified in nursing, and they went through the courses, they got their certification, and they were working as nurses taking care of these wounded soldiers and officers. The majority of her entries during this time are about this hospital and about these wounded and about how the war is going. And so they really did put in a lot of effort into the war in their own way.
They put in their time, they put in their effort.
Yes, exactly. As a lot of women did back then. So basically, they did. They didn't just sit around, and as they could have, I suppose. They did a lot, and it was not just rolling up bandages or something. I mean, they literally were involved in surgeries. We're talking, they literally passed limbs around that were surgically removed, and it was not fun and games. They were into serious stuff there.
Not something I can see any of the royalty of today doing.
Yeah, well, Yeah, probably not. I don't know. Maybe they would step up if there really was something like this needed. But this was not uncommon for royalty and nobility back then. A lot of them became nurses or doctors, and they were fully involved in this war effort.
And besides becoming nurses and investing their time, they invested a large piece of the family fortune, didn't they?
They did. They did set up hospitals with their own private money. They did set up funds. They were involved in committees and fundraisers. It's all, she describes it all in the diaries. Every day, including Sunday, it's like a 7-day-a-week thing, they were involved in this war effort. So it was really something very intense that they used to do that may surprise a lot of people.
And with the war effort not going well, and the problems at home not going well.
Exactly.
Nicholas eventually abdicated the throne, not only for himself, but for Alexei, because he knew his son could not rule with his health problems.
Right, and besides, he did not want to be parted from him, because Alexei's hemophilia was not a well-known fact. They tried to keep it a secret because they didn't want the Russian people to know that their heir to the throne is kind of on the verge of death very often, and was not expected to live very long. They felt that maybe that would bring instability to people, and they wanted to project this stable image to the Russian people. So his hemophilia was not a well-known fact, and when Nicholas decided to abdicate for his son, it wasn't just for the fact that he knew he probably wasn't going to live very long. It was also for the fact that he knew that they wouldn't allow him to raise this boy if he abdicated and probably was sent away somewhere, and Alexei was the next heir to the throne. They would not let him go with the family. They would keep him and raise him probably in St. Petersburg with a regent. And they knew that no one would really know how to care for him and how to prevent his accidents and how to make sure that he doesn't get hurt. So in order to sort of protect him, they decided that they needed to hold on to keep him in the family, and for that they needed to abdicate his right to.
What did Olga think about her father's abdication?
You know, she did not say anything in her diaries about that. That was around the time when she stopped writing in her diaries. So we don't know. We just simply don't know what she thought about it. She, all the children got measles at the time. They were all very sick. And so she was very sick. And then she stopped writing because she was sick. And then when she came back and wrote one more entry on March 15th, that was pretty much the last entry. There was no indication of anything. She did not say anything about her father's abdication or what was going on.
So she stopped writing with that last entry.
She stopped writing in the diary, and in fact, in the original book, the rest of the pages were just torn out. There was nothing else. So it's unclear whether she actually maybe wrote something else and then tore out the pages, or more likely, she just stopped writing, because the way that the last page looks, it doesn't look like anything else followed. So for some reason, she just did not write anymore. She wrote a lot of letters after that, but nothing else in the diary.
Did the letters say anything about how she felt?
Not directly. She would say a lot of things like, well, you know, going through the hard time, and Lord save Papa and Mama and you know, help them and help, you know, help them get through this, help us get through this. But she never actually went into detail about what this is. But it's pretty clear what she's talking about.
More with Helen Azar in just a bit. Got another commercial break here on... And we're into the home stretch this WIP Sunday with Helen Azar, The Diary of Olga Romanoff, Royal Witness to the Russian Revolution. And we know how the story supposedly ends, with them all being murdered in a cellar in Siberia. Do you believe they all died in that cellar, Helen?
Yes, absolutely. There was no way anybody survived that. There's just no way. Plus, even if there was some minute chance, science has proven otherwise. They're all accounted for. As romantic as it sounds to think that maybe one of them survived, unfortunately, no. They all died.
But yet the legend continues, even to this day. I know there's supposedly proof, and they did DNA testing of that woman, Anna Anderson, down there in Virginia, who claimed to be Anastasia.
Mm-hmm.
Checking her DNA against DNA of Prince Philip, who had his family tree related back to the Russian royal family. But some people don't want to believe it, do they?
Yes, it is a nice story, and I think some people would like to think that at least one of these girls survived, which, as I said, would have been nice, but unfortunately, in reality, it would have been pretty much impossible for anybody to survive that. If you actually read the details of the execution, it really would have been a miracle for anybody to be able to come out of there alive. And really, they didn't. As sad as it is, they all died.
Some of the accounts of the execution that I've looked at say, at least for the Tsarina and the daughters, the initial volley of bullets actually bounced off of them.
Yes, they had... their corsets were, they had sewn in a lot of their jewelry and diamonds in their corsets. I think in case if they were rescued or if they were moved, they wanted to have this as, as something if they ended up abroad to sell and to live on. So before they were moved, they had sewn in a lot of their jewelry into their corsets, which sort of made this shield, which later on prolonged their lives a little bit, which probably was not a good thing because they were conscious to know what was going on for a little longer. In the end, though, they were bayoneted. They used bayonets to kill them. They basically stuck it in their heads because the bayonets wouldn't go through the corsets. They when they found their remains, the skulls were broken up by what looked like bayonets, which was exactly the description given of what happened. So it all really matched, the physical evidence matched the description of what happened by those who were there. So there are no inconsistencies there.
And as brutal as the Tsar and the Tsarina were accused of being, what was done to their corpses was equally brutal, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They were burnt with sulfuric acid. They tried to burn them in a fire. They failed. They tried to break up the bones, the skeletons, in order to make sure they're not recognized. They did a lot of things to their bodies before they finally sort of threw them into this shallow grave and left them alone.
And it was not just the Tsar and the Tsarina and the children, but wasn't it the doctor as well?
Yes, the doctor and their three servants as well, two men and one woman. They were the four people who actually were allowed to stay with the family and who were willing to stay with the family in the end. And they all paid for it with their lives.
I think part of the tragedy for me is while you could argue, perhaps, the Tsar and the Tsarina had to pay the ultimate price for their transgressions against the Russian people.
Yes,
should the the children have been punished for the sins of their parents?
Well, of course not. But the reason they were all killed was because the Bolsheviks at the time were afraid that had anybody been left alive, that would be kind of like a banner for the monarchists to rally around. So if they left the boy alive, then he would be the next Tsar. If they left any of the girls alive, then they would still be rallying around them. And if there were no other males remaining, then they would try to set them up as Russian rulers. So really, it was a message to the world that no, we're going all the way. So we've decided that we do not want the Tsar, we do not want this type of rule in Russia, and we're going all the way. We're going to destroy all of them.
And not only did they kill the immediate imperial family, and probably don't have the entire list, but they killed the Tsar's brother. They killed the Tsarina's sister.
Yes.
They killed a couple of the Tsar's uncles.
Yes, cousins, uncles, anybody they could get their hands on who were not able to escape. There were a lot of Romanovs who were able to escape abroad, but all those who didn't, they all ended up being killed.
I'm amazed the Tsar's mother and two sisters managed to get away.
Yes, they did. They got lucky. They ended up in the Crimea initially, and in the end, there was a English battleship sent for them. So they were near the water. It was an easy escape route. So they were able to get on the ship and leave with their families and their servants and a whole bunch of other noble families who were down there with them. So they really did get lucky.
The Tsar's mother, in fact, was the sister of the Dowager Queen of England.
Yes, exactly. So that was part of it, too. And she, I don't think the Bolsheviks were as concerned with her because she was a dowager. She wasn't going to have any more children. So that wasn't really as high of a rallying point. But I'm sure that if had they had their chance, they probably wouldn't have let them escape either.
I think one of the reasons we know this, need to know the story today is, as I said earlier, there are many despotic families today. I think of the ruling family, for example, in Syria, that someday, hopefully, will be overthrown. And what's going to happen to them, their children, their brothers, their sisters, whatever, is a real big question. And what should happen to them is a real big question. And what can we learn from the last imperial family of Russia and what happened to them that has applicability for today? What do you think the story of Nicholas and Alexandra and the last Romanovs has for applicability today?
Well, we know this type of thing keeps happening. I mean, look at Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI. It's happened before, and it will happen again. I mean, we should be learning from history, but history just keeps repeating itself. I think that theoretically, yes, we should learn about the fact that, number one, autocracy just doesn't work. If you believe that one person has all this power from God, and if this person is not equipped to rule, it can become a real mess, as it did. Number two is I think that Nicholas missed a lot of opportunities to listen to those around him who were pretty much predicting all this. Yet he believed what was taught to him since he was a little boy, saying, well, you've been anointed by God, and any decision you make is the right decision. So how could you question yourself? And that's exactly how he thought. And in the end, it got him in trouble, it got his family in trouble, and they all lost their lives because of that. So, as a ruler, there's a lot that someone can learn from this. But unfortunately, I think that history does tend to repeat itself, so people tend to think, I think it's human nature to think, like, well, that's not going to happen to me, it's going to be different for me. But it never is. It always ends up being the same story, different time, unfortunately.
Is there a next book, Hebenezer?
Well, I am working on a book called The Russia's Last Romanovs and the Last Words, and these are the things that didn't make it, my translations that didn't make it into this book. And there's actually enough for another book. And in this new book, a lot of the other family members speak out. So it's not just Olga, but there are some entries from Tatiana's diaries and more from Nicholas, from Alexandra, from other sisters, as well as letters and some other memoirs. So it's similar in its structure to the Olga book, but there's a lot more and sort of fills. It's almost like a companion to the Olga book. It fills in the gaps where Olga's of the things that Olga's book doesn't contain.
Well, I'll be looking forward to it. Thank you, Helen Azar. The book, The Diary of Olga Romanov, Royal Witness to Russian Revolution. It's a book of history that has ramifications for today. Thank you, Helen Azar. You're welcome. It's been Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sunny Hill. Thank you, Phil Jackson, this morning's producer. And finally, my favorite quote from Albert Einstein, that which can be counted doesn't always count. That which counts can't always be counted. Stay safe. See you soon.
Hi, folks. This is Alan Thick, and as one of those TV dads, I had to teach the kids about handling money, so here goes. Rule number one, don't mess with the IRS. They're cracking down this year. They can garnish your paycheck, levy your bank account, even your home or business could be up for grabs over unpaid taxes. It's all true. But it's also true that they're offering a new way out. It's called the Fresh Start Initiative, an important government program for tax debt forgiveness. It's one of the biggest breaks the IRS has ever offered, so now's the time. You could qualify for a tax settlement that's 75% lower than before these recent changes. The experts at Optima Tax Relief will work to get you the best deal possible. Don't mess with the IRS. For tax help you need, for tax help you can trust, call Optima for a free consultation.
Open your player now to click on the banner for more info or call 800-730-8011. That's 800-730-8011. 800-730-8011. Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
Show the weekdays a good time with rooms starting from $89 per night at Borgata Hotel Casino and Spa. Escape to our world-class luxury resort. Hit a hot streak in our casino. Tempt your palate at one of our signature fine dining restaurants. Find something special in the boutiques or relax at Spa Tacare. After dark, let loose at Nix and Murmur. Then retreat to your luxurious room. Book now for rates starting from $89 per night only at Borgata Hotel Casino and Spa. The show that never ends. Visit theborgata.com for details. Certain restrictions apply. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Sevens are even luckier when you repeat them. On Thursday, February 20th at Borgata Hotel Casino and Spa, there's going to be one lucky winner every 7 minutes. Make that a 777 bonus slot dollar winner every 7 minutes. It's happening from noon to 7 p.m. To enter, insert your My Borgata card into any slot.